Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, you're listening to The BIP Show. BIP is for business, investing, and policy. That's what we're here to talk about. I'm Paul Colgan, director at CT Group. I'm here with James Whelan, macro strategist and investment manager at BFS here in Sydney. How are you, James?
Right, fantastic as always. Let's get after it today.
Joining us on the line from Amsterdam is Ken Vexler, managing director and chief investment officer at Acumen Management. How are you, Ken?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Colga. I'm well. Looking forward to having this chat and, getting into it.
It is going to be interesting. It has been a huge couple of weeks in financial markets globally and in Australia. We had the results of the US election, which we talked about last week with Larry Grossman. That was worth a small gain to equity markets
really?
Around the world.
What happened? I haven't slept since Tuesday last week.
Well, that was on Thursday, Friday. And then on Monday, we got the news that a COVID vaccine is looking very promising. And bam, stocks, especially value stocks. which you probably, from the sound of that, James, you weren't holding enough of them.
Keep talking, Paul.
Rallied and bond markets sold off, sending interest rates soaring. Okay, now, of course, just before that, there was a QE package from the RBA, a raft of other measures, including cutting the official cash rate to a record low 10 basis points. All of this is a very, very big change in the macro picture, or at least macro is one way of describing it. We might talk about whether macro means anything these days, but to talk about it all, our guest is someone who needs little introduction to people who follow Australian financial markets or indeed listen to The BIP Show. He was with us right for our second only episode earlier this year. It's Martin Whetton, Head of Fixed Income and FX Strategy at the Institutional Division of the Commonwealth Bank. Marty, welcome back to The BIP Show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Marty, let's start with the big dogs. US 10-year yield this week popped something like 20 basis points after the vaccine news. Can you talk us through that move and what else has happened in major government bonds? And I think after that, I might put you in Ken's capable hands.
Sounds great. All right, thanks.
So 10 years.
10 years. And hi, listeners. It's certainly been a really interesting week for the fixed income with interest rate markets this week. Like you said, the RBA is fresh from delivering a rate cut or a number of rate cuts, a QE package. You've got a weakening outlook for Europe and the UK and obviously a spike in the COVID cases in the US, but then suddenly along comes a potential cure for vaccine and all of the very crowded positioning, the views of the market that central banks will just inject liquidity for a long, long time to come and they won't be hiking rates is out the door pretty quickly with a very sharp spike in bond yields. And it was a pretty nasty move for developed markets. Australia, New Zealand, the US, Canada really took a big hit. There's a bit of a pareback today, but it has really flipped people to the other side of the boat in their thinking, you know, super quick.
So one quick thing before I hand you over to Ken, right? So something that probably a lot of our listeners are familiar with on the equity side is a short squeeze. A stock that everybody that enough people think are going to go down starts going up. They need to start buying that stock back, and it drives the price up very, very rapidly. Does the same thing happen in yields in bonds in reverse?
Yeah, well, you can have it both ways, I suppose. You can have a short squeeze in bonds where people are short and they have to buy. But in this instance, we were fairly conditioned by the central banks to say they're not moving anywhere. Certainly here in Australia, there's a promise, of 3 years of we're not going to be hiking rates because we need to hit an inflation and a growth target. And no one around the world is hitting that. So we knew that central banks were going to be having our backs as far as protecting the bond market central banks would buy the debt from the governments, not directly, of course, because they don't want to be seen to be doing that. But we've had, a long squeeze where the positioning was very long in interest rate markets, or bonds particularly, and everyone has tried to sell them, get out of that door at the same time. It's a narrow door, and you saw the very quick reaction to it.
So I'm going to hand you over to Ken. We have had some fascinating questions from some BIP Show listeners through Twitter, which I might put to you at the end. But Ken, I know you will have a lot of things to chew the fat with Marty over. So over to you, mate.
Thank you, Colga. And Marty, thanks. Welcome and thanks for coming on. It's good to have you on. A couple of things, I suppose, broadly speaking, I'd like to chat to you about over the course of the next, I don't know, however long. On the one side, what we started off with, Australia, and then have that as as the main feature, as it were, and then we'll maybe try and look at the global perspective on things. So, let's look at the RBA, and point blank, in your opinion, has the RBA done the right thing in terms of what they did last week?
They'll argue that they have, and I guess if any...
We're not asking them.
If there's any way that you can lower the cost of anyone's funding, it is always helpful. It does improve cash flow. What we argued for a long time was the information we saw on our own balance sheet at CBA with the very large transaction base that we see is, and feedback really from borrowers too, was that lowering rates wasn't really going to give them an extra stimulus. It wasn't going to encourage anyone to borrow money or more money perhaps. And the evidence from offshore is that Japan and Europe, where they've had low rates for a long period of time, has not really driven that. So we didn't think it was a valuable thing to do. From their perspective, the way they, framed it was twofold. Governor Lowe referred to Australian government bonds, the 10-year specifically, being higher in yield than comparable bonds around the world. Well, that's because we need about 55% of our market to be funded from offshore. Japan is somewhere where they only need about 2%. So for Australia, we need to attract buyers. Now, the upshot of that is there might be some currency buying, but I'm very sceptical on that point because the Australian dollar is the fourth most traded currency pair in the world, which is astounding to think of. And it's not because of our trade with the rest of the world, which is typically what you think of in exchange rates. It's because we're a big speculative currency. If you're an equity investor, you might think of your long equities, you can long the Australian dollar. They are the sort of risk trades that work.
It's a bridge over time zones too, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you're short China, well, you should be short the Aussie dollar.
Yeah.
And so the amount of transactions that take place in terms of foreigners buying Australian dollar bonds and buying the currency on a market that trades about $120 billion per day in the currency, there's no way that there's even $10 billion or perhaps even $5 billion per day. So it's a weak argument in our view. What they would argue, though, is that over a longer period of time, if our bonds look less attractive, then there'll be fewer foreigners buying our bonds. That means that when you've got a large issuance program like the AOFM, as the government borrow does, $240 billion for this current financial year, someone's got to buy them. And so that means that the RBA has to step up. Now, the second part of their argument is that the currency would weaken if you lower the rate structure in Australia and therefore, we're not as attractive a proposition. But there's two sides to a currency. There's there's the Aussie dollar side. Yes, weaker interest rates, but then there's the US dollar side, which is weakening for its own reasons. And you can't fight that one. That's a bigger market.
Yeah, it's just slightly bigger than ours, isn't it?
Just slightly. Yeah. So we've got a balance of payments that's moving into surplus because we're exporting more to the rest of the world, notwithstanding the drop in some of the soft commodities to China. And we own more of the rest of the world than we used to because of our fourth largest pension fund in the world, which is having to diversify into foreign assets. So we get this income stream from offshore and that props up the Aussie dollar. So it's pretty hard to fight it. I mean, look, did they do the right thing to answer your question? They did for the reasons that they think are applicable. Yep. And yes, there will be a lower funding cost. But if you look at what the banks did and That is, they lowered their fixed rate mortgages. Remember, fixed rates are only about 15% of Australia's borrowers. Mm-hmm. We're a floating rate market. And no one passed on the floating rate rate cut. So it didn't actually fix the cash flow.
What, nobody passed it on?
No, there was no floating passed on. And even I think the fixed was out, you know, it's sort of down the curve, so it's not going to really impact them in the near term. But, I mean, so basically what I'm hearing is, they've ensured ease of supply, the RBA, but they have done absolutely bugger all in terms of stimulating the demand, which, you know, is ultimately, and I mean domestically, to take up that free money. They've done next to bugger all to generate any additional demand on that basis.
But what you might get, you may not get extra demand, although you are seeing a little bit of a pickup in lending, but what you could see is that asset prices go up. And I think specifically there, when you think of Australia, you think of housing. Now, if housing goes up, and notwithstanding the $100-odd billion of cash in deposit across the banking system right now, it might mean that people spend some money if they're feeling better. And as confidence happens to have hit a 7-year high prior to that release of the vaccine, perhaps your timing could be okay on that. But I'd go back to, what do we think of as the Aussie dollar in an environment that things are getting better? You buy the Aussie dollar.
It's a risk, definitely a risk on currency.
Yeah.
It is.
Okay, so, I mean, look, I think we've sort of covered off, you know, what impact, if any, at the margin their actions may have had. But very quickly, I'm just curious, in your mind or in CBA's mind, I mean, did the RBA have any other real options available to them other than what they did?
They could buy more bonds and perhaps lower the currency, lower the yield curve that way, but it's a lot of bonds to buy. I think it really comes down to the fiscal policies of the government, and that's what they've probably done together is encourage the states to borrow more money, and you are seeing state budgets come out. They are borrowing a little bit more money. I think the South Australian budget today showed that intent. Whether or not that's going to be enough, you'll find over a medium term.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so I'm curious. I mean, you and I sort of, we've known each other for a while, and we chat back and forth every so often via WhatsApp and whatnot. So in the aftermath of last week, I mean, apparently there was some poxy election or something in the US. I don't know. I don't pay attention to this nonsense. But the RBA was the big thing. In the aftermath of that happening and the decision to lower the cash rate and whatnot, you and I spoke, and I was under the misapprehension. I want to get into the mechanics of what is now entailed. I was under the misapprehension that it was going to be a bug rather than a feature of the fact that now that the cash rate is sitting at 10 basis points, there will be occasions, not frequently, but occasionally, there will be instances where the bank bill swap rate can print negative on an overnight basis sometimes. When we spoke about it, I was under the impression that it was once in a blue moon. It could happen depending on how the stars align. But as you, and I refer back to you because you know what you're talking about and I don't, rightly pointed out that this is likely to be a common occurrence rather than an uncommon occurrence. Can you run us through what's going on?
So what you've had, and sorry for starting a sentence there with so, what you've had in the RBA's cuts is there's a bunch of rates that they now look at. There is the official cash rate at 10, which was 25 before. Nothing trades at 10. It's a sort of a penalty rate where if you don't have enough cash on the day as a bank, you pay 10 basis points for it. Actual cash trades at, today, 5 basis points, got as low as 4, and that is a function of the exchange settlement balances. Exchange settlement balances are where the RBA buys cash, or buys bonds from the banks, gives them cash in return. Now, they don't print money. They just do a wire transfer, and it creates this deposit with the banks. The banks then reinvest that. They ideally lend it to companies, people. But if they can't lend it, because this is the whole demand story, if they can't lend it, they are effectively pushed into buying assets. Now, the good side for the RBA is that as you build those ES balances up towards probably $150 billion, is our reckoning, or even higher, then the bonds get the money goes back into bonds, pulls bond yields down, prices up. What we felt was that with the ES balance rate, which was cut to zero and lower than where we thought it was. We thought it would go to five. There were some others who thought one. But at zero, it means if you have excess cash as a bank, you don't stick it with the RBA. You get paid nothing for it. So you may as well invest it in anything above the rate of zero.
And I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the banks some time ago might have had something like tens of millions of dollars in ES accounts overnight. But now it's much more than that.
Would have had about $1.5 billion per bank. And it was really just for extra settlement issues. Yep. And you minimised it because you got if you had over a certain amount, the RBA charged you 25 basis points less than that rate.
Okay.
Now we're at this lower bound where they can't charge you 25 less. They can just pay you nothing for it.
Right.
At least at 10, there was some incentive. Now at zero, you may as well stick it into something else, another bond.
So trying to move – so was it a design of the policy to move money out of those EOS?
It's a bit like QE. When people say, well, what does QE do? Well, it takes you out of safe assets into out the risk curve. And so this is, another way of looking at that. You are not incentivized to leave your money there. You're incentivized to buy bonds or lend the money. And by lowering the cost of our funding through the TFF rate, the term funding facility, where we borrow at 10 basis points for 3 years and we pledge assets against that, it's not as simple as that, then we have to find another asset. We build these ES balances up. The more amount of money there is in this ES balance pot, it pushes the cash rate lower, not the official cash rate, which stays at 10, but where cash transacts on a daily basis. We think that gets down to about 2 or 3 basis points. And as it does, BBSW, which has this bid-offer spread, so the difference between where you buy and where you sell, can probably move into negative territory on a setting because the banks won't be transacting in BBSW, which is them issuing bank bills. They don't need to because they've got $100 billion in deposits, and they've got the TFF that they can withdraw if they need funding. So we can see it pushing below zero. And as you say, Ken, on a more regular basis than sort of once or twice. Now, what that means is that you're paying money away from a bank to bank. For corporates and depositors, because there is a margin above BBSW, and for a lot of financial instruments, whether it's a floating rate note bond issued by a bank or a corporate, the margin is enough, let's call it 20, 15, 20, 30 basis points.
Or even, it goes even to positive. In this world where it's getting so tight, where it's 10.
Yeah,
right?
You're still positive on those. So it doesn't blow the system up too much, or doesn't blow it up at all. It's just more if your interbank rates are at a negative, how does that work against a lot of existing documentation?
And let's just clarify. So in terms of those ES balances, would it be Australian banks only, or are institutions like big
institutions? It's mostly Australian banks. Right. There are obviously foreign banks who have an account with the RBA. So you have to be an ADI, deposit-taking institution. Foreign banks will have a fairly minimal amount of excess balances for two reasons. One, they don't get a lot of depositors putting money with Bank of America locally. They will with ANZ or CBA or someone. They also won't own a lot of bonds that are taken from them by the RBA. So it's they don't get these huge balances. But effectively, the market's very long cash at the moment. There's a lot of it around, and that's pushing the price of cash down.
I have questions, but Ken, I'm going to let you go first, mate.
Okay. Fair enough. I understand the consequences, I suppose, of the mechanics of where we are at the moment. So that begs the next question or the next thought that I had was, where do yield hunters go in Australia? So, I mean, let's say you're an international, pension fund, whoever you may be, right? Your real money or a serious leveraged account, and you're looking for yield, and Australia's part of your mandate. Where do they go? What's attractive? Anything?
Yeah, there's still attractive things, and I guess it goes to the question that David Scott asked on the Twitter, which was misnomers around fixed income. And one is yield versus return. So you can have a very low yield, but if the price of the bond moves substantially, you can have a pretty decent return.
Sure.
So you've, even in the I guess that frothy period in 2018 when a lot of European government debt was very negative in yield, you could still make money selling it to someone who wanted to buy it at a even more negative yield, and you got a very good return out of that. You just don't hold that one to maturity when it's at a negative yield because you are losing on the capital.
Yeah, you get
stung.
And I suppose that was my – I didn't get to it, but that was exactly what I was trying to intimate is, you know, do these yield hunters, do they park it and just clip the coupons, or are they actually punting it for price? So is there,
remind me what a coupon is. We don't get them very much anymore.
Yeah, I mean,
this is the thing. You're getting a lot of the bonds maturing that had high coupons from, I guess, issued around 2006, 7, early 08. And a lot of the bonds now are coming on from the government at 0.25, 0.5, 0.75%. So very low coupon.
Let's just go back. For those who are just tuning in and like trying to educate themselves about bonds, let's talk about the asset and the coupon.
Yep, sure.
Very quickly.
Yeah, good.
So bonds are a loan and they pay a fixed rate of coupon or income per year. Depending on what jurisdiction you're in, it can be quarterly, it can be semi-annually, or it can be annually. And depending on what tax jurisdiction you're in, some of them are tax-free, some of them are not. In Australia, we have an income tax, so they're not an asset class that typically the retail person buys in Australia because it's not incentivized to do so. You'd buy equities because the dividends are franked, more or less, better asset class in that respect. Bonds can issue between sort of 1 year and, 100 years recently. I mean, you can get longer, but really, the bulk of bonds are issued around the 5 to 10 year part of the curve. In Australia, the government bond market, or the government issues debt between, effectively issues it between about 3 and 30 years, but they have obviously shorter maturities that are close to maturity. And the average of where they issue the government debt's around the 10 year part of the curve.
And let's just be clear with people, maturity means you get your money back.
You get your money back with bonds, yeah. So that's why it's often seen as this defensive asset, a safe asset, because you get your capital back with a very pretty minuscule return, whereas I guess with equities is you may not get your capital back, but, gee, you could get paid pretty well in the interim and you get the capital gain or loss by holding that.
And then the coupon is?
The coupon is the payment, the interest payment on the loan. In the same way as you pay a coupon from borrowing money for a house, for your mortgage, you're paying a coupon back to the bank who's lent you that money.
So we understand what yield hunters look for, as it were, in Australia. My question, and it's something I've been, because, well, I don't live there anymore and it's been so long since I have, what, in your mind, over the medium to longer term, I mean, what's the bull case for Australia? Like, where's how much of it is up to local or governmental authorities and how much is down to a broader global change in the overall environment?
The bull case for Australia is that you've got a lot of cash in bank deposits, which has been a very defensive move by households into a recession. As that gets deployed, where does it get deployed? You typically would move into the things that you know would make you money or have historically made you money. They're typically a real estate play in Australia. It could be arable land. It could be just owning property in major capitals because that's been good. But obviously there's a caveat to that, and that is that the net migration to Australia is something that's slowed down very quickly this year to zero and probably will take a couple of years to come back fully. And, Peter Costello once said, have one for mum, one for dad, and one for the family. One for the country.
Yeah,
sorry, you're right. And that's probably not as applicable now because living costs have gone up and, you know, the demographics don't really suit that.
Not doing that.
So the other part of the bull case, I guess, is that state governments, we don't manage our prosperity well, but we do manage our bad times well, and I think the governments of all stripes in Australia have understood that once we get into a corner, we do spend our way out of that. And it's not a bad thing that we do that. It doesn't matter that we're indebted because the cost of that money is extremely low. So if it means that they are building infrastructure that is productive infrastructure and useful infrastructure, and there are opportunities taken, and in my personal opinion, I think a lot of that should be sort of towards the energy sector, particularly the green energy sector, but yep, that's obviously something that is fraught with political differences across the country. But they are opportunities for Australia. Now, another one would be onshoring our manufacturing and jobs. If the last year is, or the last 6 months has shown us anything, that there has been this split politically around the world. Now, that may have changed with the Biden presidency, although, you know, people do say he could be just as tough with China as Trump, perhaps not as...
Well, he's expected to be.
He's expected to be, perhaps not as...
We have notes to wheel... We're going to wheel around to this, mate. Keep going.
Rambunctious, but good word, we don't use that often enough. That could actually create employment in Australia if we were onshoring some of our manufacturing. So there are opportunities there, but you don't just... turn on a factory. These things take planning, land acquisition, and they could be a couple of years away.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, so, I mean, if I've understood correctly, a lot of it, rather than relying on a broader global picture, comes down to the government getting its act together, which I'm a major seller of that happening, but that's just me. It's just because exactly that, the infrastructure and all the planning that needs to go into it needs somebody to be able to look past their own nose and not just down it. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that the current administration in Australia is capable of doing that. But I'm editorialising here and I'll move swiftly on. Yes. Now, so that takes care of Australia, as it were, for now. So I want to turn, I suppose, to... you know, macro, and I hasten to put air inverted commas around it because, well, I'll explain to you in a minute. I just want to run past you, Marty, something that, you know, I've personally long held to be true, and I want to get your opinion on it. Maybe we can, you know, sort of have a chat around it. I mean, it's very likely that this is a naive take from me, but I've long believed that, broadly speaking, the market as a whole, irrespective of asset class, is broadly a punter's market. So if you're real money, if you're a pension fund or anything of that ilk, you generally set your portfolio and you sit on hands, and occasionally you tweak it just to make sure that the balances are correct. And otherwise, you pretty much sit on your hands and do three-fifths of bugger all, right? Manage the currency risk if you're globally diversified, maybe. If your mandate and your risk manager, for example, allows for it, then quite frankly, you just go out and punt. Otherwise, to my mind, you might as well just go buy some trackers and go fishing. To justify the methodology post-fact is probably just, you know, best saved for marketing and pitch decks. So as far as I'm concerned, macro, as I knew it, as probably you knew it, is all but dead, right? It's there in name. You either punt or you don't. And the asset class of choice being the sole discriminator of whether you're macro or not. What's your take?
It's a pretty good summary. I think the larger your portfolio, whether it's equities or bonds, although I'd say this is particularly the case with fixed income bonds, is how do you outperform your benchmark? You really need to have a very solid trade that gets the duration, the spread call right, the curve shape right. And that's a pretty hard thing to get right all the time or consistently, and do it to such a degree that it really tilts your portfolio in a big way for great performance. Most funds, I wouldn't say they all think alike, but there is obviously an element of groupthink or an element of everyone either being educated the same way or talking to the same strategists or talking to this or seeing the same information and having it right. It's not like, for example, everyone was short rates going into the November RBA meeting and one lot was right, and so the numbers for November are going to show that one fund was particularly long interest rate markets and did really well. Everyone would have some degree of it. It's, you might be 3.5, you might have a benchmark that's 5 years for your that you have to match in the duration, which is your interest rate sensitivity, and you might be 5.25 years, you might be 4.75 years. For half the month, it worked to be 5.75.
So how do they balance that in
they'd
in
buy
the,
longer
in terms
bonds,
of the investments?
They'd buy some more 30 years or more 10 years and less of the 2 or 3 years.
So you sell twos and
you sell twos and buy tens. So that's actually called a curve flattener because the shape of the yield curve goes flatter. I'm using my hands here, which is not much use on a radio show.
If enough people do it.
Enough people do it. And then, of course, in this sell-off we've seen in the last 3 days, the yield curve has steepened very sharply, and I think the price action showed that more people were on the flattener than not. And to your question about the punters in the market,
So you mean people were more positioned for the flattener?
Yes, i.e. that longer rate bonds, longer tenor bonds would outperform shorter tenor bonds.
Yeah, so there was more demand all of a sudden, or so there was more selling at the longer end.
Yeah.
So you've got to get out of that, right? Yeah,
and that was a harder one to get out of. And the punters that...
And it was a harder one to get out of.
Why was it a harder one to get out of?
There are few buyers the longer you are out on the curve.
Yep.
And
so liquidity, same stocks.
Yep. And also when everyone's trying to get through the same door.
That's all right. We got. There's compliance points here. It's amazing.
And then why are they selling the longer dated bonds?
Because their sensitivity to a reflation view or a positioning unwind means that that's the part of the curve that they've got to get out of it. So now, they don't have to get out of it, but their performance as the curve steepens 20, 30 basis points in their face means they're going to reassess their view very quickly. And the punters in the market who drive that price action, who are probably a bigger factor through things like futures contracts, can really set the price of the market.
All right. So if there's real money...
Yep.
Right, versus speculative money, right? So let's go back to real money, so pension funds, et cetera.
Yes.
Right. They see the value of their bonds dropping. Now, in your experience, do they go in at that point and see the value of those bonds dropping with the yield steepening, right? And there's the combination of that return that you mentioned that they have to calculate. Would the real money decide to sell at that point, or is it more the speculative money, which is long the total return of long dated bonds?
So real money basically refers to investors who have cash that they invest in markets. They don't borrow money. Speculative or leveraged money means that you can get an outsized return. Being long or short a market, whatever that asset class is.
And borrowing against that position.
And you're borrowing against it. So you have a larger exposure if things go wrong or right. You can look at both sides. And when things go wrong, you're a forced seller or a forced buyer. And their price action would drive some behavioural change from real money. Most of the real money would not have suddenly sold and said, oh, the curve's steepened so much, we've got to get out of the market right now. They possibly would trim positions and reassess and say, we didn't think this would happen. We might buy some more up here. We might actually trim a bit of our position.
So what do we know about leverage bets in the long end of the bond market?
So the only information you can get there, unfortunately, is what the US Commodity Futures Trading Commission publishes 1 week in arrears, called the CFTC, shows the net speculative longs and shorts across contracts. And they were showing that it had some reasonably long positioning from the speculators. And that says the market is long, i.e. looking for lower interest rates, and the sensitivity was skewed towards 10 or 30-year futures contracts. Gives you a proxy for what the cash market was doing, but it doesn't mean that they behave in the same way.
So if anybody's wondering, you can always get that. That report is publicly available.
Yeah, that's right.
It comes out on Friday.
Comes out on Friday night, Saturday morning for Aussies. And oddly enough, it only runs to the prior Tuesday. Tuesday's the cutoff. I mean, somewhat apt if you ask me, but yeah, that's a different story.
I know, that's okay. Now, can you get a question? Then I've got to ask a question for my guys.
Last one, I suppose. Leveraging off this macro side of things. Have you noticed, I suppose, in the last couple of years, let's say, Marty, that real money, by virtue of the environment globally and returns and whatever else that we're seeing across asset classes, some of them are beginning to behave more like leveraged accounts? So they become a bit more punter-esque rather than sitting on their hands?
Yeah. Yes, and you see that because yield curves are a lot flatter and there are yields are lower. There are a lot a lot less opportunities to to just simply make the carry and roll down, which is just owning the bond, assuming it stays in the same place and getting the interest rate differential as the bond comes closer to maturity. And so what you've seen as an example of that is when the allocations for – or when a new bond is being issued, and we've seen four new bonds issued by the Australian government in the last 2.5 months, the participation from investors has been mammoth. You know, we've never seen demand like this before. And it's because you look at it and say, but the most they can make is maybe 3 or 4 basis points as a difference relative to the two bonds around that point on the curve. And yet they'll pile in, do as much of that as they can in the way that leverage would do it. And if we, for a bit of an economic history lesson, go back to 1997, 98, long-term capital management did exactly this trade. They would scrutinise the very micro differences between a June, July and August bond and say, well, the July is 2 basis points cheaper than the June and the August. We'll buy the July.
And we know what happened
there. We know what happened there.
Off we go. Yeah.
Now, so they blew up.
Well, the problem was that every bank had the same trade on.
For the new investors.
For the new guys.
Long-term capital management, just Google it.
It was more short-term.
It was okay. But with LTCM, also, they were going through a whole bunch of different custodians and settlement providers as well, and that really confused it too. I'm an ops guy, and that's what we
were. Yeah, they were just on the wrong side of a trade that, when it unwound, blew everyone, including them, up. I mean, who got their money in the end is a different story, but it was the mother of all blow-ups. But anyway, here we are.
I do want to point out one thing, though, with these. So when the RBA does an auction, right, there are specified...
AOFM.
AOFM. When they do an auction there for Australian government bonds, there are a specific number of institutions that are able to buy those.
Right? Yes.
So it's like JPM, you guys...
Four major banks, Macquarie, Mizuho, Nomura, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, about 14.
Yeah, so you can't just rock up with $1 billion and say, I want to buy that.
No.
Right? So,
not
right,
with that attitude,
so,
Paul.
Right. So I want to buy a whole...
But if you have it, we can talk to you.
Someone will find you. Don't worry about that, Paul.
Right. So, right.
Let's talk after the show.
As mentioned, Martin is, head of fixed income strategy at the Commonwealth Bank.
Moving on.
So... but the rates that that list of designated what are they called?
Is primary dealers.
Primary dealers. So the primary dealers can get these rates on it, right? On these things, and the issue is then how that washes out in terms of the. I think what's really fascinating to ordinary person out there is like how the rates that the primary dealers get on a bond, right, get, first of all, transferred into the real economy,
yep,
but then also how that bond then gets traded on the market, on the secondary market, which is where the RBA is buying the bonds.
Yeah, sure. Right. Okay. So it's effectively looking at the path of a dollar. So the AOFM issues the money, issues the debt, and the banks have to bid for it. And it's a competitive auction for it. They take their share. Might be a few percent, 5, 6, 10% each, depending on what your risk appetite is, and they will buy that for themselves, partly, not that much anymore. There's not as much of the bank owning the bonds, but then they'll buy it on behalf of customers that they on-sell. Now, they on-sell it at pretty much the same price or the same yield. It's a very competitive market now. So, whereas in times before, you could have made 0.5 basis point, which is it's very little, but it means a lot when you're talking about $500 million or $1 billion of bonds to an institution that has a cash flow in, needs those bonds, takes them off the bank. So then that institution, ABC fund manager, owns those bonds, holds them in the portfolio. If there is outsized demand for those bonds, i.e. more people want to buy them, then the AOFM is looking to sell, so $8 billion of interest and $2 billion sold, that can typically pull the bond yield lower short term.
By how many basis points on a typical
loss? 1 or 2 basis points, and it'll be all relative to the bonds around it. But the more buying there is relative to the amount supplied, it should lower the yield structure. So if you think about it in terms of what is the process right now, the RBA is buying $4 billion of government bonds per week, $1 billion of semi-government, which is state government bonds per week, so $5 billion of debt issuance, of debt purchases. But let's talk about the four only from the government. The government is issuing between $3 and $3.75 billion per week.
Just say that again. The government is issuing...
The government in Australia, the AOFM, is issuing about $3 to $3.75 billion per week on the current run rate of what they need to do by the end of this financial year. So there is a net purchaser of the RBA buying versus the AOFM selling the bonds, as well as what the market is buying from the banks, from the fund managers, from central banks, etc., who are also buying debt around the world, and they have interest in the market. So it should, all things being equal, pull yields lower. Now, of course, what happened in the last 48 hours means doesn't really matter because everyone's gone the other way on the trade. But broadly, that's how it works.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got my last question, and thank you, Ken. I reckon you've run an amazing thing. This is going to be the last question. Maybe we might have a couple of the Twitter questions that'll come in. But my last question, and this is one that, so watching the FT Global Boardroom last night, Justin Trudeau, you know, it's always nice to see the Canadian Prime Minister, you know, just doing his thing with his, you know, he's a lovely guy to watch, very easy on the eye, very casual, and doing his thing. And he said the same thing that I've said to clients, the presidents and prime ministers all over the world have said, which is, it's fine, it's going to be a piece of cake to pay this back. We can borrow as much as we want to pay for the COVID, because at the rate that we've got to pay it back, it's like nothing. My clients are asking me, and I've sort of said, okay, but who's actually on the other side of that?
You are. Your pension money. Your pension money is invested to some degree in bonds. So bonds, but then banks. Banks, not as in the trading desks of a bank who facilitate client flow, but the bank has to hold liquid assets, government bonds, against their for regulatory capital. So if you want to find a buyer, you regulate and you make them buy. You know, what happened in the last crisis, second last crisis, because I think 2012 was a crisis too in Europe, but in the 07, 08, 08, 09 crisis, a whole lot of government bond was issued, and the banks were told, well, you've got to buy this stuff. And so the banks now own it. And the banks hold it because it's a liquid asset that can be converted to cash at any one time. So there's always a buyer. And it's not like the famous view of Maggie Thatcher's...
you run out of other people's money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not that way.
Yeah.
And, yes, the interest rates are lower, so the cost of servicing that debt's extremely low. Do we pay that back? No, but we don't need to. It's a bit of a fallacy. And
that's
this is the Stephanie Kelton view of the world, and I think a lot of what she says is pretty bang on. It doesn't always work, especially right now when, you know, when you're thinking about the cost of that money versus the growth rate, and the growth rate is lower. But in the end, growth will pick back up. So your growth over a long period of time, as long as that's higher than the cost of the money, it should work.
Okay. So if I can jump in, can I just go to some Twitter questions?
Sure.
All the way from Amsterdam, I can hear your eyes rolling at the Twitter questions.
I don't know. I don't log on, man. I don't know.
Are you on Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
There's
Twitter. Okay, so I'm going to go through a few. There are some very good ones.
This is going to be great.
And this is so interesting. It's from Alex Joyner, who's the chief economist at IFM Investors, right, which is a big fund.
Very nice man.
And he's a very nice man, a very smart economist, right? And his question is that APRA, which is the banking regulator in Australia, it designates fixed income as a defensive asset class. And how much more defensive can it get in a world of zero interest rate policies and seemingly limitless QE? Right, so let's start with that. There's a follow-up, but...
The fallacy of it being a defensive asset class, or, you know, can be on occasions an asset class you buy when you're worried about the returns of well, when you're worried about the equity market and I guess the global economy, and that asset class obviously hurts in that period, and safety of bonds where you're getting your money back at the end, particularly when it's from a government issuer. But when the lower yields go, the more interest rate sensitivity bonds have. And if they if everyone is owning bonds at the lowest point in their history, and let's not call the end of the bond market just yet, you have a distribution curve that is very much skewed towards yields could go higher and the prices therefore lower. You could lose a lot of money. So it's not that defensive. It's defensive when it's held by a bank for regulatory reasons.
So I looked at the 12-month chart for the 10-year US and and the Aussie.
Yep.
They're very similar.
Similar, yes.
So there was a little bit of a rise leading into the start of the year, going up to 1%, absolutely collapsed, went to 50 basis points. In fact, the last time we were talking was about, it was around about 50 or 60 basis points, and now it's back at about one. So this isn't, you know, like, it's not like a bond, buying a bond is not a victimless crime, right? So, you know,
it's the not coupons you're getting, the interest rate payments you're getting along the way, do not compensate for those price moves.
No, they do not.
That's why it's not necessarily defensive.
Particularly if it's like, you know, 100 billion or that you know, you're a pension fund and you've bought 100 billion in 10 years. Okay, so the other question that Alex had was like, what if all this stimulus actually works, right? So do you get risk-free returns or do you get return-free risk?
Get return-free risk.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, that can be pretty punishing when we've and if we go back 4 years to the last election cycle when yields were near their lows, as it were, and they rallied or they pushed up by I'm going to say about 160 basis points, and it was if I recall, it was 802 days before they came back to that level. So it was a very long period where you would be underperforming as a fund manager. Owning bonds
against that.
It was a 3-hour cruise, and you all ended up being back. Gallagher's Island.
I've not heard that before. Everything that's some very good chat over there from you over there, KV. Nice work. Right, next question.
Tim Kelly, I think we've all know, he's a genuine fixed income buyer. He's on the buy side. With the RBA QE and Pfizer's vaccine news being announced a week apart, first question, was the RBA too late to the QE party?
Oh, gee. No. They were doing what at the time, and obviously there was a process of thought within the RBA to do what they were doing. Had they have not done it, and they'd signalled along the way that they were going to do it, you would arguably say
over about 12 months or something.
Yeah, the Aussie dollar would be a lot higher, and that would be a crimp to the export side. Not that there's any students or tourists coming to Australia anymore anyway, but just, I guess, on Aussie dollar exports. Late to the QE party, I don't think they ever wanted to go there. And so they've almost been forced there, and Guy Debelle did a speech about it, if I recall, December 19, where he said we'd be looking at what other central banks around the world are doing, and because the others are expanding their balance sheets, it was probably for them just a case of they have to follow the herd.
Heath Moss.
G'day, Heath.
Hi, Heath. Who you'll sometimes see on Ausbiz.
He's a good mate of mine.
Yeah, he's a good guy. His question, which I think is very relevant after this week, Heath is at HLM Investments, and his question is, with rising US yields, when does the Fed cap it and how would they do it?
So the more yields rise, obviously there is a tightening in financial conditions for the US. At the same time, as the dollar falls, they are helping themselves on their export front. So it's, you know, it is useful in that respect. You'd imagine simply that the Fed would maybe buy a little bit more if they chose to, or they would give some soothing words around forward guidance, which just says we're not hiking until we meet these preconditions, which is what they've already said in terms of inflation and unemployment. And it goes back to Alex's question a little bit of what if this catches on. If it does catch on, then it's actually not a bad thing, because ultimately you'd like all economies to be humming along quite well, and you can still pay that debt back.
So
pay it down.
So Scotty, my former co-host.
G'day, now, David.
Hi, David. Who's doing now a fantastic job over
at, killing it.
Oh, Ausbiz. Yeah. The most terrifying interview in Australian financial media, I reckon. And also the most fun.
Yeah.
So
let's not get into his looks here. I mean, go easy on the bloke.
He's a good bloke. He's a good bloke.
The first thing he said, which was actually a really good question, which is what's the thing most people get wrong when it comes to understanding yields and bonds? And we all had a pretty good chuckle. To understanding bonds. We all had a pretty good chuckle about it because...
Price and yield.
Okay, so let's not go there. But he did follow up very well on that by saying, like, what's the second on the list of bond market misunderstandings?
Probably that split between whether they're a defensive asset or not, because they can be a very attractive asset to make good returns. And then really it would be also the yield on the bond versus its return. So a low yield doesn't necessarily mean it makes low returns, because if it rallies, if the bond price goes up, yields fall. Just to clarify that one again.
We're all going to get that right.
You can make a lot of money, and that's the benefit of something called convexity, which is your interest rate sensitivity.
Aha! So that was the magic word. Okay,
that was the phrase that pays, kids.
Okay, so bond convexity. So you can be long convexity or short convexity.
You can.
Explain the convexity.
Convexity is interest rate sensitivity, and so the longer the tenor of the bond or a swap, because that's also an interest rate instrument, the higher value it is per point that it moves. One basis point in a 2-year is not worth very much. One basis point in a 30-year is worth a lot. And that really plays out when you have in a bad way for bond fund managers as yields rise, because you typically have a long convexity position, and as yields rise, you are more punished for the longer bonds that you own. So your portfolio loses more as interest rates go up.
Right,
because it magnifies. It magnifies that basis point.
If I'm the like a pension fund, and I've decided I think things are going to be bad for quite a while, and I start buying Swiss 50-year bonds or something. Swiss government.
Austrian hundreds,
mate. I've got a couple of Austrian hundreds in the portfolio. Don't worry about that.
Here's a simple way of saying it.
Yeah, come on.
If you think interest rates are going to rise by 25 basis points from an RBA hike, you can buy the 2-year and you have 2-year bonds. For each basis point it goes up, it's worth about $250 per million. If you have 10-year bonds, it's worth about $1,000 per million. If you have the 30-year bond, it's worth about $1,300, $1,400 per million.
That's right. So if
they're in a parallel shift higher in the yield curve, you get really punished for your 10- and 30-year position.
So I'm just on the Austrian year bond, I saw...
Well, the Hanji?
Yeah, was it the Austrian 100-year.
Yeah.
I saw a guy from who was head of fixed income strategy at JP Morgan give a presentation a few years ago in London. And the guy managed $500 billion.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. He was a really good presenter. He was quite funny. I did an interview with him, a very interesting guy. But one of the things he started off his presentation with was Austria just issued a 100-year bond. Now, I don't know about you, but I do think that Austria 100 years ago has had quite a few changes in terms of how its government looks.
It's the way of the world now, my friend. So, it's the way of the world. It's okay.
But I think, I know.
It also has a 0% coupon.
The 100-year bond.
Yeah, from memory.
I got to check my notes on coupon again.
Really?
Yeah.
When there are a couple of issues?
There was one in 2016 and there was one in 2019. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the original paid something and the follow-up was maybe a zero coupon, which is unheard
but,
of.
But it goes back to that question of the interest rate payments, that the coupons you're getting hardly pay for the...
Exactly.
So what's the point? So we've done convexity, we've done the Austrian hundreds.
There's a currency swap question. Right. So, and this is from Nick Mucci, who I have never come across.
But, g'day, Nick.
He's probably happy about that.
Long time listener, first time, whatever.
First time question submitter to Martin Wetton on the
beach. G'day.
Okay. If reflation expectations keep building in the US, which they are, steepening the curve, mm-hmm. which they are, will.
This week.
Will Phil Lowe's QE be sufficient to keep Aussie yields and the Australian dollar in check? So I suppose what he's asking is, will if the inflation, the reflation story keeps building globally, is $100 billion sort of QE package enough to like weigh on the long end of the curve
In a relative sense. So it doesn't matter about the absolute, because what Phil Lowe was talking about at the time of his speech was our bonds yield relatively more than others. And if we make our bonds less attractive, they don't have to be at a certain level. The yield curve control is the three-year part of the curve, and he wants to keep that where it is. That's for domestic borrowers.
If the 10-year goes higher,
that's okay. As long as it's not going higher than the US rates, and $100 billion would be enough, because that goes just to the maths of they buy $4 billion per week, the AOFM issues between 3 and 3.75 per week, and so there's a net reduction of bonds in the market. It should pull things lower. If our inflation expectations rose, if our consumer confidence jumps up again, if we start to see house prices jump pretty sharply, then perhaps that would present some difficulties. It may mean that they'd have to do more.
The strengthening of the Aussie dollar, which has been that's one of the shocks.
That you can't really control unless you come in and actually intervene in the currency, and that's not on
They're
the,
not
on the
it.
Cards.
Don't start that conversation. That's a whole new podcast.
Okay. Kit Lowe, who is a friend of the show,
G'day, Kit.
Has a very... funny question.
And might I add, I know Kit personally, and he's also one of the best what used to be known as locals back when the floor existed. And since then, he's still a local, just in a different... He's probably one of the best punters in that space that I've ever met. So g'day, Kit, if you're listening. No, he's a good bloke, Kit. Got a lot of time for him. There's about three other people on the planet I can say that for. But anyway...
If I can just put it this way, I've known Ken for quite some time now, and I have never heard him speak that about anybody.
It's the first compliment I've ever heard him give. Right, what's Kit's question?
So he just had a throwaway comment saying, I heard coupons are like dividends for sophisticated investors.
That's what they are.
The name escapes me, but there's a Christopher... something with a J is the surname. I think he was a big... proponent of that theory, wasn't it? Coupons are divvies for sophisticated investors. Never mind, moving on. Wolverine, something?
It's the best way of describing it. Anyway, go on.
I've got one last one, which I'm sure you'll be happy to indulge, because you mentioned Stephanie Kelton earlier on. Mm. When Scotty asked, what's the thing most people get wrong when it comes to understanding bonds, and Josh Nicholas, who's... a journalist at The Guardian now, and all-round good guy.
He's top bloke. G'day, Josh.
He is good. And his answer to this, like one of the things that most people get wrong about it, is that bonds exist. Which leads us into a rabbit hole. Right now, it's where we are well over the time that we allotted to this.
I've got to get to my pack again, Paul. Come on.
But let's go back to this thing of... this question of what Kelton calls in the deficit myth, the difference between green dollars and yellow dollars, that there's the debt, government debt is just a dollar in a different form.
Yeah.
Right. And that actually they could pay for whatever they need to. So currently they borrow to pay for some of the things.
Yes. And
part of the other issue is just why don't you just issue the dollars to pay for the things? Which is part of that. And he's being clever and being kind of provocative and fun on there. And I think this is a really interesting intellectual conversation that is being had in a lot of places at the moment. Do they exist
when a government issues and a central bank buys, because it's one hand paying the other? And, you know, the RBA will own, you know, what is it, $60 billion of bonds at the moment, up to $160 billion at some point, and they get the coupons from those bonds, those interest payments, and they will pay those back to whom? They'll pay those back to the government. So it is very circular.
To
the Australian government, who's the issue. They're buying the Australian government's debt. They're doing it via the market, not directly, even if they were. It really wouldn't make a difference in the chain, because the government would be paying the RBA interest on that, and the RBA then pays a dividend of that interest back to the government. So you could say, do they exist in that form, because it's just one arm borrowing from the other. But in the case of a bond investor, a real money investor, a hedge fund, a bank owning it for regulatory purposes, absolutely they do exist. And there are, you know, yield points, the points on the yield curve, there are duration plays, there are spread plays within state government versus government, and all of those things do matter.
Marty, thank you for all of that. Ken, do you have any last questions?
No, I'm good. I'm golden.
Okay, look, everybody, listeners, don't forget to subscribe to the show. Rate us, leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on iTunes at The BIP Show. We're on Twitter. It's at @BIP_show. And we're on Facebook too. Just search The BIP Show. We're all there individually at Colgo, at JamesWillen42, and at Martin_Wetton. Don't forget to hit subscribe, rate the review. We love those 5-star ratings. Thanks, everybody. The show's produced by Eamon Connolly and Rick Salter. We'll catch you next time. Thank you so much for listening.